Imagine for a second that you were completely, utterly alone.
And not just like a quiet weekend alone.
Right. No, not just sitting in a room or going off the grid. I mean, something much more terrifying. Imagine you can't even trust that your hands are real.
Yeah.
You can't trust that the sky outside your window is blue. You can't even trust that your memories of, you know, eating breakfast this morning actually happened.
It's basically the ultimate isolation tank. It's the whole brain in a vat scenario, but way before The Matrix was even a glint in Hollywood's eye.
Exactly. You have stripped away absolutely everything. The only thing, you know, the absolute only thing you can hang your hat on at this point is that you exist as a thinking thing.
Because you're having thoughts.
Right. You have thoughts floating around in your head. But outside of that, it might all be a simulation. It might be a dream. It could just be a massive lie.
It sounds like a psychological thriller, honestly, but this is actually the existential corner that René Descartes painted himself into in the 17th century.
The famous I think, therefore I am guy.
That's the one. Philosophers call this state solipsism. And it's a, well, it's a terrifying place to be philosophically because you're trapped.
And today we are doing a deep dive into the prison break. We're looking at a fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes. He breaks down Descartes' Meditations 3 and 4. And the mission here for this deep dive is massive.
Huge.
We are trying to bridge the gap between I think and the world actually exists.
And here is the catch. This is what makes it such a high wire act. We have to build that bridge using only the materials found inside our own minds.
You can't use anything from the outside.
Nothing.
It's basically MacGyver, but for metaphysics. He has to build an entire universe out of nothing but his own thoughts.
That is a great way to put it, because at this stage in his philosophy, specifically coming out of Meditation 2, Descartes has stripped away everything. He can't use the physical world as proof of anything, because he hasn't proven the physical world exists yet.
Right, so he can't look at a sunset and say, wow, God must have painted that because the sunset might be a hallucination.
Exactly.
He can't look at the complexity of the human eye either, because he's not even sure he has eyes yet.
He is literally locked in the dark room of his own mind. So Dr. Holmes walks us through how Descartes starts rummaging around in there to see what tools he actually has to work with.
Taking inventory.
Yeah, taking an inventory of his own consciousness.
So let's look at this inventory together. If all I have are ideas, I need to know what kind of ideas they are. Holmes explains that Descartes sorts the furniture of the mind into three distinct categories.
And this isn't just busy work. This categorization is crucial for his entire strategy. He's sorting them based on their origin.
Where they seem to come from.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's break these down because this is the foundation for everything that comes next. What's category one?
The first one is innate ideas. These are ideas that are native to us. They just arise spontaneously within the mind.
Okay.
Now, importantly, Holmes points out that Descartes isn't saying these are memories from a past life. It's not like what Plato thought.
Right, so it's not like I remember the form of beauty from some realm before I was born.
No, not at all. It's more like they're clear and distinct concepts built into the operating system of our minds.
Like firmware.
Yeah, think of it like a computer. When you buy it, it already knows how to do basic math or how to organize files.
Okay, so pre-installed software. That makes total sense. What's category two?
Category two is adventitious ideas. The word comes from advent, meaning coming from the outside. These are involuntary.
Like sensory stuff.
Right. For example, if you hear a loud explosion outside your window right now, you didn't choose to hear it. It forced itself upon you. Nature teaches us these come from external causes.
But, and here's the problem we established at the start. Descartes can't trust these yet, right?
Because the outside world is still in doubt.
Exactly. That explosion could just be a trick of the mind.
Precisely. He acknowledges them. He says, you know, I have these ideas that feel like they come from outside. But he can't use them as hard evidence yet.
Got it. Now, category three is my personal favorite, mostly because the source material gives such a bizarre example. Factitious ideas.
Yes. These are voluntary. These are the inventions of the mind.
And Dr. Holmes uses the very specific example of a fairy giraffe with butterfly wings.
A classic image in philosophy.
I just love that. It creates quite a picture.
It really does.
It's a fictitious idea because I took the idea of a giraffe and the idea of a butterfly, and I, the thinker, glued them together in my imagination. I made it up.
It's a cut and paste job. And this distinction right here is the absolute key to the escape plan. Descartes is about to try to prove the existence of God.
Okay.
But to do that, he has to prove that the idea of God isn't a fairy giraffe.
He has to prove he didn't just invent God because it sounded nice or comforting.
Exactly. And he also has to prove it's not just adventitious. It's not just something he picked up from the outside world casually.
He needs to show that the idea of God is something completely unique, something that he couldn't possibly have created himself.
Right. And this brings us to what is probably the heaviest lifting in this whole deep dive. The source material gets incredibly technical here about the reality of ideas.
Oh, yeah. That's part.
We need to distinguish between objective reality and formal reality.
And I have to be honest with you, when I first read this part of the lecture, I had to stop and reread it like 3 times. The terminology is, well, it's just not how we use those words today at all.
No, it's definitely not. In modern English, when we say objective, we mean fact, and subjective means opinion.
Right.
But for Descartes in the 17th century, objective meant existing as an object of thought. It refers to the reality an idea possesses as a representation.
So it's about the content of the thought itself, like the data density of the idea.
Yes, that's a perfect way to think about it. Think of it like the resolution or the complexity of a blueprint. If you have an idea of a finite substance, like a rock, it has a certain amount of objective reality.
Okay.
It represents a simple, finite thing. It's like a low-res JPEG.
A thumbnail.
Exactly. But the idea of God, a substance that is sovereign, eternal, infinite, immutable, all-knowing, that idea is an 8K resolution.
It has the maximum amount of objective reality because it represents something infinite.
It is the heaviest idea you can possibly hold in your mind.
Okay, so in my head, the idea of God is the most detailed, most real file I have stored. So what is formal reality then?
Formal reality is actual existence in the external world. You and I have formal reality because we actually exist. We take up space, we have mass.
And the fairy giraffe.
The fairy giraffe has objective reality because you can picture it clearly in your mind, but it has zero formal reality. It doesn't actually exist out in the world.
Okay, I think I'm tracking now.
Yeah.
Objective is the picture in the mind. Formal is the physical thing on the street.
Perfect.
So how does he use this difference to prove God actually exists? Because right now, sitting in his room, all he has is the idea.
Yeah.
He has the objective reality.
No.
He doesn't know if God has formal reality. He just has a really high-res picture in his head.
So here he introduces a principle he calls the natural light, or what nature teaches us. And the rule is this. The cause must be at least as great as the effect.
Meaning you can't get more out of the effect than was put in by the cause.
Exactly. You can't boil a gallon of water with a single match. There has to be enough power in the cause to produce the effect.
That makes sense.
Now, apply this to ideas. If I have an idea with infinite objective reality, the idea of God, what caused that idea? Where did that massive file come from?
Well, could I have caused it? I mean, I'm the one thinking it. I made up the fairy giraffe. Maybe I just made up the infinite God, too.
Yeah.
Maybe took my idea finite and just sort of stretched it out.
And are you infinite?
Definitely not. I mean, I can't even remember where I put my keys half the time.
Yeah.
I doubt things. I make mistakes. I am very finite.
Then you cannot be the cause. That is Descartes' trap right there. A finite being cannot produce an infinite effect. You literally don't have enough reality in you to create the idea of an infinite God.
It would be like trying to pay a $1 billion debt with a $10 bill.
You just don't have the funds.
That's a really helpful analogy. I can create the idea of a fairy giraffe because I've seen giraffes and I've seen butterflies. I have all the raw materials. But I don't have the raw materials for infinity inside me.
Correct. You are imperfect. So where did the idea of perfection come from? You couldn't have scraped it together from your own imperfect experiences.
So if I couldn't have invented this idea because it's just too big for my finite mind,
then the cause must be something that actually possesses infinite formal reality.
Therefore, God exists.
That is the causal argument in a nutshell.
It's fascinating because he's backing himself into a corner where God has to exist. Otherwise, his own thoughts literally make no sense.
Yeah.
He's saying, I have this thought in my head that is too heavy for me to have carried in here myself.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And doing this, it shatters solipsism entirely.
Right, because suddenly I'm not alone in the room anymore.
Exactly. The source material really highlights this pivot point. If I couldn't have invented this idea myself, then solipsism is false. There is, beside myself, some other being who exists as the cause of that idea.
The prison door is finally unlocked.
It is.
There's a metaphor Dr. Holmes cites from the text that I think really drives this home nicely. He calls the idea of God the mark of the workman.
Yes, the mark of the workman impressed on his work. It's the idea that when God created you, he stamped his signature on your mind.
So it's an innate idea.
Right. It wasn't drawn from your senses. You've never seen God with your physical eyes. And it wasn't made up like the fairy giraffe. It was implanted there from the beginning.
And the source goes on to say that we actually see this signature by looking at ourselves. This part was really interesting to me. It says that by reflecting on my own nature, I see the negative space where God fits.
That's the image of God argument. I look at myself and I see that I am incomplete. I doubt. I worry. I make errors. But I unceasingly aspire after something better. Now ask yourself, where did I get the idea of better? Where did I get the idea of perfect to compare myself against in the first place?
Right. To know that a line is crooked, you have to have an idea of a straight line. To know I'm imperfect, I have to know what perfect actually looks like.
Exactly. I must have a standard of perfection in my mind to even realize that I am imperfect. And since I'm imperfect, I couldn't have created that standard.
The standard had to come from a perfect source.
Yes.
It's a psychological proof almost as much as a logical one.
Yeah.
It validates that sense of longing we all have. But I want to pivot here for a second.
Sure.
Because for the listener who might be wondering, okay, great, Descartes proved God exists. Why does this matter for science? Why does this matter for logic?
Right. Like, is this just theology we're doing or is it philosophy?
Exactly. Because Dr. Holmes connects this directly to meditation 4 and the problem of error. This seems to be the big so what of the deep dive. Why does proving God exists help me trust that the chemical reaction in my beaker is real?
It absolutely is the so what. You have to remember, back in meditation 1, Descartes was terrified of a malign being or an evil genius who might be constantly deceiving us.
And you think 2 + 2 = 4 when it's actually 5.
The ultimate gaslighting?
Truly the ultimate gaslighting.
But now that he has proved the existence of the God of the Bible, a God who is, by definition, perfect, he has a weapon against that fear. Holmes explains the logic really cleanly.
How does it work?
Well, God is perfect. Fraud and deception stem from defect or imperfection. Therefore, a perfect God cannot be a deceiver.
So because God exists and is perfect, he wouldn't build me with a broken calculator for a brain.
Precisely. If God gave you a faculty of reason and you use it correctly, meaning you only accept what is clear and distinct, you can trust it.
Because God isn't tricking you.
Right. This validates reason itself. It validates math. It validates science. We aren't being tricked. The universe is honest.
That is a massive shift. It validates the entire machinery of the human mind. And speaking of machinery, there is a historical comparison in the source that I found totally fascinating. Dr. Holmes talks about the difference between the divine light and the light of nature.
Oh, this is a critical piece of intellectual history. Holmes compares the medieval view with what Descartes is doing here. In the older tradition of Augustine or Bonaventure, the mind knows truth because it is enlightened by divine light, the logos.
Okay.
It's almost like God is shining a flashlight into the mind to reveal truth.
So in that medieval view, I only know truth because God is actively revealing it to me right in this moment. It's an act of dependency.
Yes, exactly. But with Aquinas and then definitely here with Descartes, there is a major shift. The light of nature or natural light isn't God shedding light on the mind every time we have a thought.
Right.
It's that God created the mind with its own natural luminosity.
Oh, I see the difference. It's not God holding the flashlight. It's that God built us to be flashlights.
That's it. And Holmes points out that this sets the stage for the entire Enlightenment. And for scientists like Newton, it's not God said, let Newton be. It's God created Newton's mind with the capacity to figure out gravity entirely on its own.
It validates human reason as a standalone tool.
It really does.
That is incredibly empowering. It's basically the permission slip for modern science to go out and investigate the universe without needing a priest to interpret it for them.
It is. It's the Declaration of Independence for the human mind.
But we do have to be fair to the source material here. Dr. Holmes doesn't just cheerlead for Descartes the whole time. He points out some serious cracks in the foundation.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this whole argument relies on that one specific idea, the idea of God. If that idea isn't what Descartes says it is, the whole thing collapses.
It does. And the biggest critique involves a bit of a logic trap. You might be asking, and many listeners probably are, why didn't Descartes just use the ontological argument?
Right. That's the argument that says God exists by definition. That the concept of a perfect being implies existence, because if it didn't exist, it wouldn't be perfect.
Exactly. That seems so much faster.
Yeah. Why wait until meditation 5 for that? Why go through this whole causal argument headache with objective and formal reality?
Holmes explains that Descartes actually can't use logical definitions yet. Why? Because he hasn't proven that logic is trustworthy.
Oh, right.
He has to do the causal argument first, the one we just discussed, to prove God is not a deceiver. Only then is his logic validated enough to use definitions to prove things.
He has to build a ladder before he can climb it. If he used logic to prove logic, it would just be totally circular.
Correct. But there is an even bigger critique Holmes brings up, and it goes right back to that infinite idea. Descartes claims we have a clear and distinct idea of infinity. But do we really?
Source mentions the big thing plus one theory.
Right. A counterargument is that we don't actually grasp infinity at all. We just imagine a really big number and then say, and so on. We extrapolate.
We fake it.
Yeah. And if our idea of infinity is just a fuzzy construction, basically a factitious idea we built by adding numbers together, then the whole argument falls apart.
Because if the idea isn't truly infinite, I could have caused it myself.
Exactly. If the idea is just really big, then your finite mind is perfectly capable of creating it. You don't need a god to explain a really big number.
So how does Descartes defend against that? Because that seems like a huge hole.
He insists that the idea of the infinite is primary. He says, you can't know you are finite unless you already have the infinite to compare yourself to. It's a positive idea, not just a negation of the finite.
He argues that the concept of infinite actually comes before the concept of finite.
Yes.
But is it really clear and distinct? Dr. Holmes shares a pretty funny anecdote about the subjectivity of this whole clarity thing.
Oh, I loved that part. He mentions a friend who says that the only response needed to someone who claims an idea is clear and distinct is, well, it's not clear to me.
Yeah, or the student example. Just wait until I finish grading your paper, then we'll see how clear your clear idea really is.
It's funny, but it highlights a very real vulnerability. Descartes is relying entirely on this internal feeling of clarity as a guarantee of absolute truth. But as we all know, you can be absolutely clearly and distinctly wrong.
You can be confidently incorrect.
But which is why this foundationalist method trying to build the whole universe on one or two certainties is so fragile. If that one link snaps, if that one idea of God turns out to be fuzzy, the whole chain falls and we are right back in solipsism.
Trapped in the room again.
Exactly.
So let's bring this deep dive in for a landing. We started with a man locked in his own head, trusting nothing but I think.
And we saw him rummage through his mental inventory and find an idea God that was simply too high resolution for him to have created himself.
You use that idea to prove a creator, and then use the creator's perfection to warranty the quality of his own brain.
Which allows him to finally look outside and say, okay, I can do science now. I can trust math. I can trust my senses, mostly.
It really is the bridge to modernity. As Dr. Holmes noted, we move from relying on authority to relying on the natural light of human reason.
It's the moment Western philosophy decided that the human mind is actually equipped to understand the universe.
But here is a final provocative thought to chew on, something Dr. Holmes alluded to regarding Freud. Descartes thinks he defeated the skeptics by saying, the idea of God isn't a projection. It's not a fiction we made up for comfort.
Right. Freud would later come along and argue that God is just a father figure projection, a classic factitious idea.
But the weakness in Descartes' shield is, do you actually have a perfect idea of God? Holmes suggests our idea might not be the greatest possible idea after all. So I want to ask you, the listener, look inside your own mind right now.
Take an inventory.
Do you find an idea of infinity there? Is it a clear, glowing trademark of a workman? Or is it just a fuzzy concept of something really, really big? Because according to Descartes, the validity of your entire reality hangs on the answer to that question.
It's a question that keeps the deep dive going long after the audio stops.
Thanks for joining us on the deep dive.
Keep thinking.